You're listening to Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on China's foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world. Brought to you from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, located here in Beijing, China. I'm Paul Hanley, the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, and I'll be your host. Today, we're delighted to be speaking with Randy Shriver, who is in China this week to participate in the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's Distinguished Speaker Program. Randy served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs from 2003 to 2005, and prior to that as Chief of Staff and Senior Policy Advisor to then Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. Randy has experience serving in China policy as the head of China policy for the Secretary of Defense, and prior to that service as an active duty Navy intelligence officer. Randy is founding partner of Armitage International, an international business consulting firm, and founding president and CEO of the Project 2049 Institute, U.S. think tank focused on security issues and public policy in the Asia-Pacific region and Central Asia. Randy, thank you for joining us here today. Thank you for joining us as part of the Carnegie Tsinghua Distinguished Speakers Program and for our podcast today.
Paul, thank you. Yeah, it's great to be with you, and it's been a terrific week for me, and look forward to our conversation today.
Randy, given that we're here in China, and this week you've engaged with a range of Chinese experts and scholars on U.S.-China relations, I want to look a little bit closer at the President Obama-President Xi summit. You mentioned some of the announcements that were made regarding climate, trade, information technology agreement. There were some confidence-building measures announced in the military sphere, and, of course, the announcement on visas. One of the areas of agreement that I want to come back to is on the military side, the confidence-building measures, and also the issues related to safety and of our seamen and of our Air Force personnel. And I want to bring it up because you were, when you were working at the Department of Defense for the Secretary of Defense on China, you were one of the principal architects of a platform between the U.S. and China called the Military Maritime Consultative Agreement. And I wonder, these agreements that were reached this time, how do they connect to that? It seems very similar issues that we've discussed before. And I'm interested in your views on the agreements that were announced from the military side, given your experience on these issues.
You're kind to give me a lot of credit on the MMCA, and I did have a role in it, and certainly at the time it was something I took a lot of pride in, I felt great about, but I was also on the receiving end of that agreement really failing when we needed it most, which was during the EP3 incident in April 2001. So I've lived through this process of reaching these agreements only to see them fail. So obviously, given that personal background, I look at what we've agreed to this time around and wonder if we're putting ourselves in a position to repeat the same pattern. I hope not. Mm-hmm. You know, one point that's been made to me is the mill-to-mill relationship is in a different place. It's a better atmosphere now than the 1990s, when we had very difficult relations over the Taiwan issue in March 1996, the Taiwan missile exercises. It's possibly the case that because the atmosphere is better, we can expect these agreements to be honored should we need them in the time of mm-hmm. an incident or crisis. But it's an unanswerable question right now, and the history is not great. So I think it's better to have the agreement than not have the agreement, but mm-hmm. but implementation mm-hmm. is really the key.
So implementation is important going forward, and two sides need to work hard to implement these, which was a point that you raised this week in your discussions with Chinese scholars and government officials, military officials, and business executives. In those conversations, I want to ask you what are your takeaways in terms of how the Chinese have assessed the bilateral meeting between the two presidents, APEC, and their just sort of the broader assessments of the relationship as it stands today?
Well, I think there was a lot of agreement actually in terms of the visit being seen as successful, outcomes reached that are important, but still a lot of concerns. And I sense that the Chinese side is already laying some markers. If we're to continue the positive environment and good relations, then we have to be careful about issues like Tibet and the Dalai Lama. We have to be careful about Taiwan arms sales. And I think you and I both this week have equally tried to lay the groundwork by saying that these probably will happen. And so, you know, the response from Chinese friends has been good visit, but we have concerns. It's probably the right frame of mind, but I think they're perhaps laying some markers that are pretty unrealistic.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we also heard this week, of course, from the Chinese is the importance on the Chinese side of this concept put forth by President Xi called the new type of great power, new type of major country relations. And they made the point to say that President Xi has expanded the concept from 3 points to 6 points, addressed U.S. concerns to a certain extent on the issue of core interests, probably not enough for to satisfy many. But what is your sense about this new type of major country relations? Why is it important, so important to the Chinese? And did you get the sense this time that they have heard some of our concerns and are trying to address them? And how is this going to be received in Washington, where you live and work?
I think it is important, first and foremost, because President Xi has introduced the concept and has promoted it, so we have to take it seriously. It's important because the underlying rationale is of critical importance, that we need a relationship between a rising power and a status quo power that can cooperate and avoid the historical trap of conflict when that situation has arisen in the past. I think it's also important to the Chinese because the way they approach international relations is different than we often do. They want to understand the overarching framework. They want a slogan. They want a characterization of the relationship before they can then proceed with cooperation in individual areas, where I think we're quite different, and we don't pay a lot of attention to the banner and the slogan. We pay more attention to the quality of cooperation. I think President Obama at Sunnylands said essentially that, but I think since then the administration has been willing to use the terminology, which I understand they want to be responsive to the president here and the Chinese government here. But it also means we're in a position where we're using a slogan that I don't think is fully defined, despite Xi Jinping's efforts to go from 3 points to 6 points, and still leaves a lot of uncertainty. When you say respect for core interests, even if we can define those core interests, what does respect them mean? Does it mean we have to fully accommodate and change our behavior, change our policies, or does it just mean handle them carefully? Because I think you've pointed out this week, Paul, that an issue like Taiwan, which is clearly in the core interest category of China, we've done pretty well at managing that.
And an issue we've agreed to disagree on for decades.
Absolutely. So I think the track record is pretty good. But by saying we need to respect their core interests, are they asking us for some fundamental change in that policy? Not clear to me.
Yeah, and I often try to stress to our Chinese counterparts that a starting point for a new type of great power relationship that asks one side to make huge concessions on issues of long-standing disagreement is not a realistic starting point, whether it's China asking the U.S. or, frankly, U.S. asking China.
Well said.
The one thing I want to pick up on that you said that I agree with is that it's important, if we're going to consider a new model that the Chinese have proposed, is that the content be, you know, that the areas of cooperation be added to that content. And in the expansion from 3 points to 6 points, what was interesting is there were some areas that were laid out on the Chinese side as potential areas where the U.S. and China could cooperate. And, you know, energy, I think, was one. There was a number of areas. And then even on the larger strategic issues of North Korea, the Middle East, Afghanistan. And I just, it looks to me as though at least the Chinese have heard our concerns in that area and are trying to address those areas where we think we need to enhance our cooperation. Was that your same assessment? Did you get the sense that they're trying to move into the area of actually putting some meat on the bones of this concept, to actually flesh it out so that it does actually impact the content of what we're doing together?
It does look that way, and I think it's a move in the right direction. And I hate to, I don't want to sound as if I'm pessimistic or the glass is half full, mm-hmm. Half empty, not half full. But I can look in each one of those areas and say that we have some overlapping and aligning interests, but the history of actually trying to achieve collaborative approaches, cooperation in each one of these areas is not a very good history.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say North Korea is an area where we can cooperate, and I think we've put a lot of effort into that, a lot of activity. You very much were involved in that.
Sure.
But I think we have to be honest. At the end of the day, we're looking at 20-plus years of effort, and what we have to show for it is a North Korea with more nuclear weapons and more means of delivery. And so I'm not sure we can fully put that into the success column.
Mm-hmm.
And we clearly have differences over tactics and how we approach the government in Pyongyang. And so I can kind of go through each one of these areas and give reason to be cautious and not mm-hmm. overly optimistic. But again, I don't say that in order to sound as if I don't think this is positive or a good idea. This is a move in the right direction.
One of the things that you talked about this week which impacts on the relationship is domestic politics in both Washington and Beijing. And they have an impact on our efforts in many ways in advancing the relationship. How, from your time this week, how do you see the domestic politics playing into the U.S.-China relationship going forward?
It's critical, and I wish I could leave China this at the end of this week and say I'm feeling better and more optimistic, but I continue to hear sort of a steady stream of Chinese views that it's mostly the fault of the U.S. that we have these areas of tension and disagreement, and that things that to most Americans would sound quite absurd, like Hong Kong being the product of the U.S. black hand. Just continuing to hear those things leads me to believe that it is a reflection of public opinion here, and whether or not that's a public opinion that's kind of manufactured through propaganda or government information, irrespective of that, if it's an accurate reflection of public opinion, that's a problem, because it makes it all the more difficult for Chinese government officials to advocate for
mm-hmm.
a stronger U.S.-China relationship. And clearly there are similar dynamics in the United States, but I do think there's a more diverse set of views, and
mm-hmm.
and certainly there is a strong constituency behind promoting more positive U.S.-China relations. You find that in the business community, despite some problems there, but it's still a very strong pillar of support for U.S.-China relations. You find it among academics and think tanks, and so forth. So, you know, I have concern about it. I'm sorry to say primarily my concerns on the domestic audience here,
mm-hmm.
But we both have work to do.
So I hear you saying that the summit here in Beijing between the two presidents was positive, but still work to be done on a hard agenda, and still work to be done on sort of underlying areas of tension and disagreement. But you also mentioned this week in your discussions with Chinese counterparts that we need to figure out ways to build on the positive momentum coming out of this trip. And I want to ask you, and a final question is, given your experience this week, but more importantly, your experience of having worked on China for over two decades on both defense, security, diplomatic areas, what would be your main recommendations on how to build on that momentum, on how to take the momentum that's come out of this summit and use it to carry it forward in a positive way?
Well, take this agenda seriously that they've laid out, and I think the bilateral investment treaty is one where I think if we roll up our sleeves, get our trade officials and everybody involved, I think that would be a very significant accomplishment, because again, it would play back directly into domestic audiences who
mm-hmm.
care about trade and commerce and benefit from it directly. So I think taking this agenda seriously and really working hard to implement it is certainly one key. I also think we should be more creative and reconsider some things that have been off the table for a while. And this week, one of my pet issues has been the commercial satellite launches. Right. I think there's an opportunity to look at that again. Right now, the U.S. is launching our commercial satellites mostly on Russian missiles. Why not accomplish two things? Send a strong signal to Russia about how we perceive and look at their behavior right now, but also say, you know, this is something that the U.S. and China can both benefit from, more reliable and cheaper satellite launches from the Chinese side, and obviously there would be an economic benefit from them. But that's one that would be supported by our industry, those that are producing the satellites, and I think it really does carry the potential for win-win, as our Chinese friends always say. So I would think about adding to the agenda in maybe more creative ways, and you know, another would be TPP in the trade area. I think we haven't been fully clear, or maybe a better way to say it is, a little too nuanced and a little too technical in terms of whether or not China is welcome in TPP and whether or not there's a pathway for them and whether or not we're behind that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see very full-throated support for a pathway for China, and you know, could be quite ambitious given the state of the Chinese economy and where the state-owned enterprises are and so forth. But why not be ambitious? Why not have, you know, aspirational objectives informing our efforts going forward? I think that could be very significant as well. So I think, you know, working on the agenda that's there, but even being more ambitious. And then I guess finally, we know that there's some issues ahead that will be difficult to deal with. These markers that the Chinese laid down on Tibet and Taiwan, we need to prepare the battleground for that. And you know, we basically need to say what you and I have been saying this week, which is it's coming. Here's why we do it. And, you know, we know you don't like it, but we've got too much at stake in the U.S.-China relationship to really respond in a way that jeopardizes our progress.
Well, thank you very much, Randy, for joining me for this podcast, but thank you even more for spending an entire week out here in China with the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. We appreciate you sharing your insights and your experience and your recommendations, and we hope to have you out here again soon.
Paul, thank you very much. Keep up the great work here at the center.
Well, that's it for this edition of Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. If you'd like to read or learn more about China's relations with the U.S., you can find more articles, events, podcasts on our website at www.carnegietsinghua.org. I encourage you to visit and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.